Well, welcome everybody to the latest edition of Star Cells and God. I'm Fuzz Rana. I'm a biochemist and a Christian apologist, and I work for the organization Reasons to Believe, which is sponsoring this video podcast. So if you want to know more about Reasons to Believe, go to our website, www.reasons.org, and you can follow us on social media, RTB_official. And that would be following us on Facebook and Twitter and Instagram. And I'm joined today by Jeff Zwierink, who is an astrophysicist and part of the scholar team at Reasons to Believe. And so welcome, Jeff.
All right, it's good to be here, Fuzz.
Yeah. So today, Jeff and I are going to be taking a look at some new discoveries and some new insights from the world of science and talk about what these discoveries mean for the Christian faith. So, Jeff, I think you're going to be talking to us about the multiverse. I'm going to be talking about the question of human origins and some specific features of the hominin fossil record. So, Jeff, without any further ado, why don't you go ahead and get started?
All right, very good. Yeah, so what I wanted to talk about today, it's a little bit older of a paper, but is just talking about the multiverse and some of the challenges that the multiverse brings. How can we test it? Those sorts of things. And the specific paper that I'm referring to is a paper in New Scientist. It's called "Quantum Twist Could Kill Off the Multiverse." And where the new research was coming in, or the new proposal, is looking at how do quantum fluctuations work. And then, you know, this was published back in 2014. So it's a little bit of an older paper in that sense. But I thought it was neat, or it was a neat discovery to discuss in the context of what are people thinking about how to deal with quantum mechanics, kind of these big multiverse type ideas, and some of the challenges and problems they bring, because it illustrates the process of how science works, and it also illustrates some of the challenges that dealing with things strictly from a naturalistic perspective brings. And so I think that's an interesting intersection of science and the Christian faith there. Mm-hmm. And particularly the notion in question is the way the multiverse is typically formulated, or the common idea out there, is that we live in a Big Bang universe. And so Big Bang explains, you know, the universe starts in this hot, dense state. It expands, it cools. As it cools, structure forms. We look at the cosmic microwave background radiation, and it's very uniform across the sky, and it has the same temperature. The universe looks flat. And so as people were developing this Big Bang model of the universe, they recognized some problems. One is, why is the cosmic microwave background radiation so uniform? And there were some other problems. And one of the ways of solving that problem was to propose this idea of inflation, that our universe underwent this very rapid expansion in its earliest moments. And at least at the time when inflation was proposed, it was like the universe began, it inflated, inflation stopped, and then you get our normal universe. And
so is inflation mostly a theoretical idea, or is it actually some experimental or observational evidence that undergirds it?
So I
sorry, let's pause right there for a second.
Okay.
Sorry, I'm giving Fuzz a little bit of a haircut here.
Oh, okay.
So I'm gonna give him a little space. Sure you want a haircut.
If you're gonna cut my hair, cut all of them. You know, Jeff, I'm just curious, you know, is inflation primarily a theoretical idea, or is there some kind of observational evidence that supports the notion of inflation?
Well, that's a great question, because that's kind of what I'm going to be discussing in here. But in a different fashion, is it a theoretical idea, or is there evidence for it? And so as far as inflation goes, I would argue that it was a theoretical idea of kind of put forward to solve some problems that were out there. And that would be back in the 70s and 80s, where that was really, you know, in that theoretical idea. One of those problems was, why is the cosmic microwave background radiation so uniform? But there's been a number of discoveries that say if inflation is true, this is what we would expect to find. And lo and behold, we find those things. Okay. So inflation isn't like, oh, it's the only explanation or it's better than all the other classes. It certainly matches or it solves the problems that it was invented to solve, but it's also matched predictions of future discoveries like the scalar index and in the cosmic microwave background radiation fluctuation. Okay. So it's a theoretical idea that has a lot of experimental backing at this point.
Okay.
And so, you know, this idea of inflation, you know, it explained why the cosmic microwave background radiation was so uniform on the sky. But now you go into the 90s and or late 90s or early 90s and up to today, we've measured the fluctuations in the cosmic microwave background radiation. And in these fluctuations, you are in the ripples that we see, the prevailing explanation for those are these quantum fluctuations that are going on early in the history of the universe. And that's what leads to stars and galaxies and clusters of galaxies. So these quantum fluctuations play a pretty critical role. The problem is when you apply those quantum fluctuations to the epoch of inflation, inflation actually becomes eternal. It goes on forever. And so, you know, regions will inflate, you'll get universes, but as these quantum fluctuations happen, and it plays out differently and depending on how inflation works, but inflation just kind of goes on forever into the future. And what that means is that, or it provides this mechanism where, you know, we've talked a lot at RTB about how this is fine-tuned and there's the one chance and whatever, you know, whatever the number is, there's all these probabilities. Well, when you're dealing with probabilities, that you always have to keep in account the ratio or the fraction as well as the sample size. Yeah. Well, this perpetual inflation gives a virtually infinite number of possibilities, which you now have this problem where anything that is possible can happen.
Okay.
And so if you're going to use that now, that's kind of this attractive feature to many is that the multiverse, because it's such a large sample size, can explain, yeah, there's all these weird events that have to happen for human life to come about, but the multiverse just has a large enough sample size that it's going to happen somewhere, and we happen to be in the place where it does.
Right.
The problem now arises in that if everything can happen, you have to account for every possible explanation. And when you look at the multiverse, if humans are purely physical, and that's what you've got to deal with if you're a naturalist, that's the scenario you have to have. If humans are purely physical, Jeff Zwering's brain and Fuzz Rana's brain are really are at their base level the proper assemblage of atoms and electrons. And if you, you know, they just have the right momenta, right locations. And once you get that, you've got Fuzz Rana, if you will, or Jeff Zwering. In the multiverse, these sorts of fluctuations happen. And you're going to get life because of these quantum fluctuations. And so what the proposal was, obviously that's got some problems with it, but the proposal was, you know, when inflation's happening, the only thing that exists at the time is this inflation particle. And if inflation's going on and there's nothing else out there, there's no other observers, all these quantum fluctuations won't happen. So that was kind of this novel idea or this approach that would solve this Boltzmann brain problem, which is the idea that there are just these disembodied brains floating around out in space that are these quantum fluctuations. And I just find it kind of an interesting phenomenon, one, because that's really kind of a bizarre way – or not a bizarre. It's a pretty radical way to solve a problem is say, okay, there are quantum fluctuations don't exist early in the history of the universe during inflation – because there's no other, there's nothing else around, and therefore there's no quantum fluctuation. So I thought that was just kind of an interesting approach.
So is it ad hoc, or is it kind of theoretically undergirded to make that claim?
I would say it's a little bit of both. I mean, you know, ad hoc has a pejorative term to it.
Right.
It's something that an idea that came up, but when you're dealing with quantum, you know, when you talk about quantum things, the observer plays a key role in how things look, how they play out. And so the idea that there needs to be an observer, and it doesn't need to be, observer is not some sort of life form looking at it. Observer is just some other entity, your other type of particle that could be an observer that interacts with the system, there you start getting the quantum fluctuation. So it is, it's not something that somebody came along and says, oh, these observations imply this is going on.
Right.
But it's also, when you talk about how quantum mechanics work, especially when you're dealing with the many worlds interpretation, this sort of idea is it's an idea that pervades that sort of thinking. And so it's a natural extension of that idea, even though it's a speculative, speculative ad hoc, whatever term you want to use, idea.
Okay. So this really is only having implications for the level one multiverse or for a level two multiverse?
It would be both of them because the scenario you have is that even in early in the history of the universe when inflation is happening, if inflation happens, it drives other universes to be to form.
Okay.
That gives the level two. But even within that, presumably, what's going on with those quantum fluctuations before inflation happened? Why don't you get – there's all sorts of things that are tied up in there.
Okay.
But the implications about the Boltzmann's brains, whether there's really a level one or level two, both kind of play out because either there's a beginning to the universe, which people want to try and use or you'll hope that inflation would avoid. And you've got this fine-tuning problem. And so if there's just a really large sample size, you get rid of all the fine-tuning problems. But now you have this issue of Boltzmann brains coming into existence. So it kind of impacts both of those, but in a little bit different fashion.
Right, right. And so in terms of the idea of Boltzmann brains, this is, again, just kind of a consequence of a multiverse. Then it's not, anything that really is, again, theoretically undergirded, right?
So yes and no. So the way I would describe it is for most of my scientific career, and that's, I would say, up to about the last 10 years, people recognize that human life is a rare occurrence. And they were saying, how did this really rare occurrence happen?
Right.
Whether you're looking at it from a theistic or a non-theistic explanation, you're still trying to say, how did this rare occurrence happen? And the challenge is that human life is pretty, or life and human life in particular are pretty exceptional, require a pretty exceptional set of circumstances. And so the question was, how do you make this rare, or how do you explain this rare occurrence? Well, now you've got a multiverse. It's not anything that can happen will happen. So obviously, if we're a possibility, we're going to happen somewhere in the multiverse. But now you've got this additional thing that you have to consider is what other ways might you get life? And so we want to say that we're ordinary observers, that there's this Earth where these reactions happened early in the Earth. You get life. This life has changed and grown and developed over the last 4 billion years. And ultimately, you get human observers that have the capacity to look out and understand the creation or the universe. That's what we want to say we are. But if the multiverse exists and these quantum fluctuations pervade, you end up with this other scenario where you could have these quantum fluctuations that fluctuate life into existence. And by almost all measures of counting, these Boltzmann brains vastly outnumber ordinary observers. So by what measure do we say we're ordinary observers? Because the most likely explanation is that we're a Boltzmann brain.
Right.
But if we're a Boltzmann brain, why would we trust anything that we've thought about? Because for the Boltzmann brain, it's more likely that the memories were fluctuated into existence and that they actually happen. And so these are the cognitive dissonances that arise from Boltzmann brains existing in a multiverse anywhere.
Right. Now, is there any way to marshal this insight to make a positive case for Christian theism? I mean, in a sense, what you're arguing here is that you wind up with these really seemingly contrived scenarios if you're going down kind of a materialistic pathway to try to account for the universe. So it's really pointing out kind of the maybe incoherency is a little bit of a strong word, but you wind up with these uncomfortable scenarios. Mm-hmm. But is there any way to take this and make like a positive case for for Christian theism.
Yeah, and I think your description is good. And one part I wanted to emphasize in there is that, you know, it would be very easy to look at this and say, ah, the naturalists, they're just dreaming up scenarios. The reality of it is this is how science operates. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, things that we hold near and dear, like conservation of energy, that energy can neither be created nor destroyed. Well, back in the 50s, as people were looking at, you know, the universe was expanding, they said, well, maybe matter is created out in the vast expanses of space. And so they put out a model for that and, you know, said, here's how it could be tested. And ultimately why that idea went by the wayside was not because it was speculative or whatever, it's that it didn't match the observations. And so the person, you know, Sean Carroll, the fellow who's putting this forth, is saying, what sort of measurement, you know, asking the question, what sort of measurements could we do that would either validate or invalidate this? So this is really just a part of how science works, especially when you're operating at the forefront of what our knowledge is. But as far as putting that into a positive case for Christian theism, this is where I would argue, you know, so it's often characterized as, okay, you either got a multiverse or you've got God, because the multiverse, if it exists, it solves all the fine-tuning, gets rid of the beginning and everything, or you've got God and there's fine-tuning and there's a beginning. But as I think about this, there's a feature of this problem that a naturalist has to deal with that as a Christian, I don't. In that sense, the multiverse fits very comfortably into my way of looking at things.
Right.
Because the only reason I have to worry about Boltzmann brains is if they're actually sentient conscious beings.
Yeah.
Well, as I look at things from a Christian perspective, and again, not all Christians would agree on this, but the prevailing or the dominant position of Christians is that we are not just physical beings, that we are a union of physical and spiritual, that there's this mind-body duality, if you will. And so in that sense, whether there are other brains out there or are the atoms arranged to look like a brain or not is not really a big issue in my book as a theist, because the only place where Jeff Zwerink exists is where God has infused or made the physical body and unified it with the spiritual component that. I think is ultimately where we're going to solve the problem of consciousness, is something where there's a physical and a spiritual component. And if you restrict yourself to just the physical, just the material, there's going to be ideas about how to solve it, but I don't think they ever will. And so that's where I think it's a very fruitful area of research, is can we make this sort of idea of there being a God who's created things would play into this discussion of how do we explain consciousness? And I think it's got some testable consequences there.
Yeah. And something else that I'm gleaning from, you know, what our discussion here is, you know, oftentimes I hear the idea of the multiverse being portrayed as, well, this is just a loophole that materialists or, you know, atheists are appealing to as a way to get around the implications that God exists.
Right.
Yet that their whole motivation for this is really kind of an anti-theistic motivation. And what I hear you saying is that, you know, this is, again, part of science, that they are operating from within a framework of methodological naturalism, and that within that framework, they are exploring possible explanations for fine-tuning as part of the scientific enterprise, not as part of some kind of anti-God agenda.
That is really the case, and I would say it's also muddied because so I'll just give you a little bit of background and my understanding of how the idea of inflation that we hold today really got on the map. There's one problem that exists in particle physics of why are there no magnetic monopoles in the universe? Because most of our grand unified theories predict that there ought to be magnetic monopoles, you know, single magnetic charges like single electric charges, but we don't see any evidence for them. And so one fellow, Alan Guth, who if you've heard about inflation, you've heard that name, was working on how to solve this magnetic monopole problem. And what he recognized is that in these era of where the grand unification and symmetry splitting was going on, and that it realized that there could be this period of where you've got this phase transition where the universe expands very rapidly, and that would solve the magnetic monopole problem. So this is where the idea germinated, if you will. And then there was this recognition that, hey, if this went on, that would also solve why is the cosmic microwave background radiation the same? Why is our universe so flat? And so you could make a very real case that the whole idea behind inflation had nothing to do with solving this cosmological problem of whether God exists or not, but it really had to do with why are there no magnetic monopoles? Now, that's complicated by the fact that Alan Guth is a self-professed skeptic, doesn't believe in God. You know, so I tend to restrict myself to not speculate on people's motives unless if they told me what's going on. But you can make a very solid case that the reason why we think inflation is true.
And a consequence of inflation is are the multiverses.
Exactly right. Yeah. At least our understanding. You know, the way I say it, if inflation happened, we live in a level one multiverse. If our mechanisms for inflation are correct, we live in a level two multiverse. That's the implication of what we have with inflation. So. But, you know, I think it's just a fascinating discussion because you get in there and obviously there are motives involved in why people do what they do. Right. But that's, you know, I do think science has this cool feature that it's not about the ideas. It's about can you test them and validate whether they're good or bad, whether they work or not. Yeah. And so, you know, even though Sean Carroll's coming along and saying, wait a second, we don't have any quantum fluctuations during the inflation era because there are no other observers, it sounds like a bizarre idea, but it's not really whether it's a bizarre idea. It's like, how can we test it and what can we do with it? And that's a very real sense where I think Hugh has a great insight in saying, hey, how do we build a testable creation model? Because it's not so much whether the idea of God is there. It's like, can we use that in a way that it's testable? And people can disagree whether we've done that well or not. But that's really the way science works. Right. Here's an idea. How do we go test it?
Yeah. Yeah. That was a lot of fun, Jeff. You're done, right?
Okay. Yeah. I could talk forever about the multiverse, but we'll stop there.
Yes. Well, we're only in a level one multiverse, so yeah, I guess you could talk forever in one universe about the multiverse. But, you know, if people want to dig deeper, you've written a couple of books, I think, that are relevant to this. One is Who's Afraid of the Multiverse, which has received quite a bit of acclaim, and then also Escaping the Beginning.
Yeah, well, Escaping the Beginning has two or three chapters where it specifically talks about Boltzmann brains. You know, there's even a discussion of that and is there life out there, because these are the sorts of ideas we have to deal with in those questions.
Okay, so then there's really three books that people want to take a look at if they want to dig deeper.
Right.
Okay, Who's Afraid of the Multiverse, Escaping the Beginning, and Is There Life Out There?
Right? That is correct, yes.
All right, great.
So let's switch over. I know you wanted to talk about human evolution and hominids and stuff. Yeah. So why don't you illuminate us with some interesting stuff about the fossil record?
Well, I'll start off with a little story that actually has, I think, some bearing on what I'm going to be talking about. And, you know, you and I both kind of grew up or lived in the Midwest. Mm-hmm. So we know what brutal winters can be like. You know,
we know what actual winters look like.
That's right. Not only what brutal winters, but actual winters look like. Yeah. Yeah. And so here in Southern California, people complain about the winter weather. But, you know, as the old joke goes, you know, how is weather in California like pizza? Even when it's bad, it's still good.
Okay.
So yeah, the worst winter day to me is spring in the Midwest.
Yeah. Right.
But anyway, we do have a winter season, and things do get a little chilly from time to time, and there's a lot of moisture in the air in the winter because this is the time of the year we get most of our moisture. And so on those cold, moist mornings, you know, everybody's windshield is fogged up. And so, you know, the first thing I do when I get in the car in those mornings is I turn on the defrost, you know, and I'm very impatient. So I'm already backing out of the driveway before my windows are cleared. And I don't like really having the defrost on. And so I turn it off. And then anything that gets any of the windshield that has become cleared gets fogged up again. So it's constantly turning on and turning off the defrost, where there are moments of clarity and then things fog up again. And and that's kind of what it's like if you work in paleoanthropology and you study the hominin fossil record, is that there's a lot of chaos that exists in terms of how do we understand the evolutionary relationships among the different hominin species. And you know, most anthropologists have perspectives on what those evolutionary relationships are. Unfortunately, there's very little agreement, you know, among anthropologists. And, you know, the hope would be that new hominin fossil discoveries would help to bring clarity. And usually they do momentarily, but then as we start working through the implications, that clarity dissipates. And again, we, you know, things are all fogged up. The windshield of paleoanthropology gets fogged up again. You know, and a lot of people have this perception that, you know, anthropologists have human evolution all worked out. There's this ironclad case for human evolution, you know, that we know what our evolutionary ancestors were because we see this kind of this ascent of man, you know, icon that everybody's familiar with. But the fact of the matter is we don't know what the evolutionary pathway was, starting with some kind of, you know, basal hominin at 6 million years ago to modern humans. Most of the creatures that we would think would be part of that lineage actually are understood to be evolutionary side branches and evolutionary dead ends. And then even when it comes to, again, the evolutionary relationships among the different hominins, there's, again, a lot of speculation. And when new discoveries are made, everybody goes out and redraws their trees, and they still don't agree with each other. And there's a beautiful illustration of this problem that was published recently in a journal called Evolutionary Anthropology by a team of anthropologists from the University of Winnipeg. And they were specifically focusing on what they called the muddle in the middle, which is a window of time in the hominin natural history from about, maybe a million years ago to about 300,000 years ago, where there's just an enormous amount of confusion as to what's actually going on from an evolutionary perspective.
That sounds pretty significant because that's the time period right before humanity shows up, correct? So
yes.
This isn't like, you know, a weird, it has direct bearing on our understanding of human evolution.
Exactly. And it's not because there's a dearth of fossils. There's a lot of fossils that we have in that window of time. The question is, how do we make sense of it? And this is a real problem. And their work focuses on a particular hominin called Homo heidelbergensis. And this is a hominin that presumably lived between, about 750,000 years ago and maybe 300,000 years ago.
Okay.
And the problem here is that people question if Homo heidelbergensis was actually a bona fide hominin specimen. In other words, they dispute whether the species actually existed. Now, there are fossils that have been discovered that have been attributed to Homo heidelbergensis, but it turns out that Homo heidelbergensis has become kind of a catch-all category. If you have a hominin fossil that you discovered that doesn't fit anywhere, you call it Homo heidelbergensis. And so Homo heidelbergensis specimens have been discovered in Africa, have been discovered in Europe, have been discovered in Asia. But the problem is that these hominin fossils actually have features that conflict with one another, that are incompatible with one another for specimens that would be grouped in the same category and as the same species.
Now, that sounds like a kind of bizarre scenario to get to. I mean, you know, I'm just sitting there listening to your description and kind of thinking about, okay, scenario. I mean, you know, we were just talking about inflation and what all is going on in cosmology. And there are people who have, inflation didn't work or maybe modified. You know, there are kind of subgroups of people who think that our prevailing picture is incorrect. But there just doesn't seem to be that level of confusion in cosmology. It kind of surprises me because biology tends to have this, we've pretty much got things mapped out, or at least that's the language that is used in public conversations. Is that what's going on there?
Yeah, well, it's not the case whatsoever.
Okay.
You know, the public portrayal is human evolution is very simplified.
Okay.
For the public consumption. But in reality, there is some fundamental disputes going on as to how to, you know, understand the hominin fossil record. And in fact, even how many actual hominin species even existed. Now,
before I go, it does seem a little strange to me that, okay, so you got this Homo heidelbergensis, which, okay, the first one or two that comes in there, but your description, if I could be a little snarky, it sounds like Homo miscellaneous.
Yeah.
Yes,
that is okay. That's the concern, right?
And, okay.
And so this team from the University of Winnipeg was looking to try to address this issue. Sorry, I'm not here. This is very inelegant, and I apologize. But this is not an inconsequential problem, because Homo heidelbergensis plays a significant role in a number of evolutionary models for human origins. So on the right, and this is an image I've taken from a journal article published in Current Biology, but it's just a beautiful illustration of where people think Homo heidelbergensis fits in. And so on the right-hand side, the evolutionary tree labeled B, we see Homo heidelbergensis as being the ancestral species that gives rise to two branches, one culminating in Neanderthals and one culminating in modern humans,
okay.
Right? And so this is considered to be the most recent common ancestor to human and Neanderthals. On the other side, we see another model that is also fairly prominent, where Homo heidelbergensis is actually considered to be a part of the lineage that led to Neanderthals.
Okay.
So they see this as a transitional form leading to Neanderthals, where in this model, Homo antecessor is being envisioned as being that most recent common ancestor of the human and the Neanderthal lineages.
I just sitting here looking, and you've got, the Neanderthal looks basically the same, the human looks basically the same, antecessor, directus. Heidelbergensis looks very different in the two. I assume that reflects the hodgepodge nature of the fossils that are there.
Exactly. So this team from the University of Winnipeg was reevaluating a particular hominin skull called the Bodo cranium. It was found in an area in Ethiopia dating at about 500,000 years ago. And as they analyzed this, they drew the conclusion that actually, in light of this Bodo specimen, that really Homo heidelbergensis does not exist as a bona fide species because they saw similarities with the Bodo specimen and the heidelbergensis specimens that were discovered in Africa. So they argue that really Homo heidelbergensis just needs to go away, and that all the heidelbergensis specimens in Africa should really be classified as Homo bodoensis, which is a new species that they're introducing. As part of this, they also want to get rid of a species known as Homo rhodesiensis, where they argue that the specimens assigned to that particular hominin really belong to Homo bodoensis, and that Homo rhodesiensis just needs to go away. Now, part of the motivation for eliminating Homo rhodesiensis is because this hominin was named after a guy by the name of Rhodes, who was a very brutal colonist.
Oh.
And so it's kind of a part of the cancel culture.
All right, okay.
It's just like, why should we name a hominin after this guy that wasn't very nice, right? And so that was part of the motivation. Then what they argue here is that the Homo heidelbergensis specimens in Europe really should be classified as early Neanderthals, and that in Asia there are these Homo heidelbergensis specimens that they don't know what to do with. They just say, well, this is just another evolutionary lineage, and that's where they pause or they stop. And so here we have the reanalysis of an existing hominin specimen, and that single reanalysis has rewritten human evolution, where we've eliminated Homo heidelbergensis as a bona fide species and have replaced it with Homo bodoensis, which actually they argue is part of the lineage that led to modern humans. And so this is how they re-envision this evolutionary tree. This is actually from their article, where they see Homo bodoensis as being on that lineage that led to modern humans, and they don't know now what is the most recent common ancestor that gave rise to the Neanderthal branch.
Okay.
They argue that perhaps it might be a late appearing Homo erectus that is the most likely candidate. They in their analysis, they think Homo antecessor is an evolutionary side branch. But notice that we've seen three separate evolutionary right. trees here, all, you know, looking at the same hominin fossil record. So
so it seems like, I mean, I was just trying to put all this into a picture. It's like, okay, as a you know, just as an astrophysicist, what do I walk away from this? It seems like the clarity of what's actually going on in human evolution from the fossil record is far more muddled and unclear than what it's often portrayed in the simplistic yes. descriptions.
Yeah.
Even at the level of, are these hominids that we think are there, that right. we've got fossils for, there's at least some of them that are up in the air as to whether they even exist or not.
Yes.
So I know I've heard Christian say this. I've thought this myself. It's like, it seems like this is so muddled. It's like, it's easy to cast aspersions on the science and the scientists doing this.
Right.
I don't think that's the way to go, but how do we respond to that? Or what do we do with all this?
Yeah, you know, and again, you know, what you see is this moment of clarity that then is, as you reflect upon it, is introducing additional confusion. Mm-hmm. What do we do with the specimens in Asia? What's the most recent common ancestor? We don't really know. You know, and so we have to keep in mind that, you know, paleoanthropologists are, you know, working with a very limited, you know, sample size where you're dealing with, you know, partial hominin remains, you know, where you are, you know, sometimes these remains are deformed, mm-hmm. you know, because through the preservation process in the fossil record, you know, that we don't have enough of a sample to know what is the, mm-hmm. the natural variation within a species, or how does that variation change with time or right. across geography. So you really are looking through the glass darkly, right? To quote the Apostle Paul, you know, and so it's a challenge. So part of what we see here is really reflective of that challenge, you know, mm-hmm. that, you know, so we do have a good understanding of the biology of these creatures. We know they existed, but how do they relate to one another in an evolutionary sense? This is not, again, you know, well understood.
So this is where the tension I have with that comes in. You know, again, I don't know. I've not studied biology. There's a reason why I chose physics. I just like it better. You know, what you're describing seems very reasonable. And, you know, in terms of the scientists I know and you know, the physicists and the cosmologists, there's, you know, well, we think this, we put this out, and there's kind of this understanding of what we know and what we don't know. But it seems like when it comes to biology, at least as an outsider, there's this very strident, we've got this human evolution, we've got evolution all figured out, don't question it. But then I see this and it doesn't seem to reflect. It's not that this isn't good science. I think the science is fascinating, and it seems like the scientists are aware of the limitations, but it gets portrayed far more conclusively than the science seems to support. Yeah. So how do we...
And I think a lot, to be fair, I think it is a reaction against, you know, creationism and intelligent design, you know, where you hear people say, well, you know, human evolution is a fact. The theory is, how did it occur,
mm-hmm.
right? But, you know, I've heard Greg Kokel say once, and I thought it was a good point, is that, well, if you don't know how that it occurred, how can you say that it occurred? Those are not actually separate questions,
right?
You know. So, but I think a lot of times the what you see portrayed publicly is out of a concern for what would ID proponents, what would creationists do if this understanding was more widely available, if these scientists were forthright about what we know, what we don't know, what speculation, mm-hmm. you know, what actually is secure, secure understanding.
Yeah. Well, and it seems like, you know, just as a, I don't know, maybe an admonition for myself as a Christian and other Christians, is to realize that we can escalate. It seems like we have escalated
right.
the discussion, and we could de-escalate it as well.
Right. And, you know, and this gets into another conversation, and this is going to be a controversial statement, but I think the attempts on the part of young Earth creationists and then later the ID proponents to get young Earth creationism and intelligent design into the science classroom actually created a backlash that has done more damage than good, because people are now afraid to publicly talk about these kind of uncertainties because they think that this is going to be abused versus,
right.
you know, if that those events hadn't happened, I think these conversations would be, you know, much more available to the public,
mm-hmm.
right? And you know, I think there's a theme emerging today, and that is we want to be careful about using this confusion as evidence against human evolution. It's not,
mm-hmm.
right? There's good reasons, even within an evolutionary framework, why this confusion exists. But what this confusion does allow someone like me or you to do as someone who holds to a creationist perspective is to say, well, you know, if this isn't really well established, it leaves a space for an alternative model where you would say maybe a creator steps in and he creates, you know, the mm-hmm. Australopithecines, the Habilines, the Erectines, the archaic
right.
Homo sapiens, modern humans. And it could still even allow for microevolution within those broader categories,
mm-hmm.
but it allows you to at least introduce an alternative model, you know, because clearly I think you could argue that human evolution isn't established. The hominin fossil record is clearly
right.
unequivocal, but how do these hominins relate to each other? And, you know, to me, a diagnostic in science is what happens when a new discovery is made.
Mm-hmm.
Does that new discovery lead to greater clarity, you know, or does it create, you know, more confusion?
Mm-hmm.
Well, if it creates more confusion, that to me is an indication that maybe the theoretical framework we're operating in is problematic. It is either incomplete or is deficient or maybe even completely invalid.
Right.
Right. And so to me, what I'm seeing here is a diagnostic that suggests that, you know, human evolution is far from a well-established, robust theory,
mm-hmm.
you know, in spite of the evidence that people might cite in favor of it.
Yeah, I think that's at least it fits with my personality of the way I like to look at these things is that, you know, if I'm going to say, yeah, this is true, there's a lot of evidence pointing yeah. towards that. And it seems like in this area, rather than have to say my model's right, yours is wrong, it's like as a Christian, I have a very legitimate place to come in and say, yeah, given all the best scientific data, the idea that God created humanity is still a robust idea. And, you know, it just kind of at least fits with one of the reassuring things I've found is that if God is who he says he is, we're never going to discover something other than what he's revealed in Scripture. And so it gives me space to step back and say, I don't know where all this is going to cash out, but I know that what Scripture revealed is going to hold
right.
itself true. But it also allows me to take a more measured approach to things and not be
yeah.
so worked up about
right.
The other side or a discovery that
right.
appears antagonistic to my views. And
yeah.
It allows me to engage those conversations with people who may believe very differently.
Right. Well, you know, and you know, to build off of that point, again, I'm a skeptic of the claims of human evolution. But I can still enjoy the study of the hominin mm-hmm. fossil record, you know, as a Christian who's again a skeptic of human evolution. I can enjoy the debate that's going on among the scientists in looking at the insight that different mm-hmm. you know perspectives bring to bear. What's interesting is that this proposal by this team from the University of Winnipeg has been criticized as well. So there are people like Christopher Stringer, who's a well-known anthropologist at the Museum of Natural History in London, said, well, you know, there's really no reason to get rid of Homo rhodesiensis. Why not, instead of calling Homo creating a new hominin species, just put all the Heidelbergensis, you know, in under Homo rhodesiensis, right? You know, and then he argues that maybe Heidelbergensis still should be around as a species, but that we would just confine it to Europe, and mm-hmm. it's the predecessor to Neanderthals. So
right.
there's other ways that people
right.
are reacting, you know, to this proposal. So it's not, you know, universally accepted, which again is part of the point, is that there's an active debate going on. Now, something else that I think this discovery has implications for is a recent model presented by William Lane Craig
mm-hmm,
in his book,
right.
In the Quest of the Historical Adam, where he is making an attempt to try to integrate what we know about the science of human origins with what the biblical account of human origins describes. So it's
right.
He's really looking at how do you create an integrated model that accounts for all the data.
Mm-hmm.
And so what he's doing is really very similar to what we do at Reasons to Believe, which is how do we integrate what we know from science with Scripture,
right,
you know, into a coherent framework. So I very much appreciate what he's trying to do. He's a, you know, someone who I respect immensely and admire, who's impacted, you know, my life and my ministry in many, many positive ways. But, you know, in his book, In the Quest for the Historical Adam, he does present what I think to be a pretty radical model for mm-hmm. how this integration takes place. And, you know, in the book, he makes a strong case that Adam and Eve were indeed real historical individuals, which mm-hmm. is one of the strong points of the book, I think.
Right.
That he's not arguing that Adam and Eve are mythical, but are representatives, but really sole progenitors, you know, of humanity. But he takes the perspective, however, that Genesis 1 through 11 is what he calls mythohistory,
okay.
that it has the features of a myth, that it's not to be read as literally true, that it is a mythical description, a sacred mm-hmm. narrative that explains why the world is the way it is. But he argues that there are historical considerations, the chronological presentation of the events,
okay.
allusions to what appear to be real places and maybe even real events in human history, and the allusion to real historical individuals. So he calls it mythohistory, where it would be as if the people that are mentioned are, again, historical individuals who are placed in a mythical account of our origins. So he calls it mythohistory, and he argues that because it's mythohistory, there's no incompatibility with an evolutionary origin of humanity
mm-hmm.
and the Genesis 1 to 11 account. But then he argues that we have to turn, in a sense, to science to ask the question, who was Adam and when did Adam live?
Okay.
And he concludes in a nutshell that Adam was a member of Homo heidelbergensis, that God selected okay. and then biologically and spiritually refurbished and became the sole progenitors of humanity. So it's and that Adam lived 750,000 to about 1 million years ago.
Okay.
And part of his...
So this would place the progenitors of humans, or Homo heidelbergensis, would that end up leading just to modern humans, or would Neanderthals and Denisovans then be included as part
right.
of the progenitors, and they were
yes.
human, even though we don't call them that
right.
in the scientific terminology?
That they would be image bearers
okay.
as
All
well.
Right.
Right. And he makes an argument from the archaeological record that Neanderthals were really like us.
But
now what he's forced to do is that if you have both humans and Neanderthals as being image bearers, then it means that the ancestral species that gave rise to them must be image bearers as well.
Right.
And so that's why he argues that Adam must have been a member of Homo heidelbergensis.
Gotcha. Okay.
Because I don't know that you could make the case that Homo heidelbergensis actually fits the criteria that even Craig presents for what constitutes
mm-hmm.
what constitutes a human, or the you know, and what would be an image bearer.
So at first glance, your discovery here that Homo heidelbergensis may not even be
yeah.
a hominid would cast that in doubt.
Right.
But in some sense, what Craig is saying is that whatever the predecessor
right.
is, whether it's heidelbergensis or this
right.
Boda or whatever, that would be the original humans.
Right. Yes. But here's the problem is we don't know. So now you've got Adam is in this nebula is mm-hmm. a member of a ill-defined nebulous, you know, shadow species.
Right.
Right. Which, you know, to me creates some discomfort, but. The most likely candidate then for the most recent common ancestor would be a late appearing Homo erectus.
Okay.
Well, in his book, Craig rules out Homo erectus
okay.
as being human, both from the archaeological record as well as from the anatomical features.
Gotcha.
And the brain brain size capacity. Well, if that's the case, then you now have again. A problem of where do you place,
mm-hmm.
you know, where do you place Adam? And if you do argue, well, maybe the late appearing Homo erectus specimens could constitute humans,
mm-hmm.
Well, then what do you do with the early appearing ones? Because they still are members of the same species. So now you've got Adam being, you know, some of the members of that species not being, not qualifying for Adam, and others are. So it creates a muddled scenario at best.
It sounds like, you know, I mean, in some sense, if you're arguing that human evolution is a muddled or muddied waters, it's like, okay, there's some good material, there's some stuff that we know to be true, but there's still a lot of unknown. And as a result, I don't have to take any of these claims with absolute certainty. That's kind of where Craig's put a model out there. It's got some big problems. It could be entirely wrong, but it's interesting to investigate.
Well, and I very much appreciate the fact that somebody of Craig's stature is not only engaging the question of human origins, but is actually looking to put forth an integrated model.
Right.
I see the same thing with our friend Josh Schwamidas.
Right.
This is a collection of integrated models. Mm-hmm. We are trying to present an integrated model, and we all are approaching it from differing perspectives. Our models are indeed different, but I think it's healthy because now we've got ways of using scientific approaches to evaluate which of the models actually, you know, makes the most sense. And I think the point I'm making is that nobody's got a good model, you know, and everybody's has limitations to their model, and that just because you approach the question of human origins from an evolutionary perspective, which allows you as a Christian to be in the scientific mainstream, doesn't mean that you somehow have escaped problems.
Right. Yeah.
Right. And I think that's a point that I would like to make. But I really do appreciate the fact that Craig is looking to approach this in an integrated fashion, because I see a lot of Christians who are trying to separate the biblical account from the scientific record. Yeah. They're not looking for any ways for these things to interact.
Yeah, the integration is that they're just distinct features, and you don't have to worry about how they interact with one another. Yeah.
Right, and that to me is not very satisfying as well.
Because I agree,
when you look to integrate it, you now are it presenting a model that I think is much more likely to challenge or to appeal maybe to a non-believer, right? It's much more likely to engage a non-believer with the idea that that maybe there really was a historical Adam and Eve, and maybe the biblical account of human origins is actually credible, and that you need to entertain the gospel because of that. Whereas when you're keeping these two areas separate, there's nothing that motivates a non-believer from even investigating the truthfulness of the Christian faith.
Oh, thanks. This has been a very interesting discussion. I appreciate getting deeper insight into areas outside what I know. So I've enjoyed our conversation.
Oh, yeah. This has been a lot of fun. And hopefully people that are watching, the Star Cells and God have enjoyed the conversation that Jeff and I have had. And I would really, if you're watching this, invite you to let other people know about Star Cells and God. Share it on social media. Share links to the program with your friends and family members and people that you think might be interested in these science faith questions. And again, I would encourage you to go to our website, reasons.org, to learn more about Reasons to Believe and to check out the resources we have available. Follow us on social media, RTB_official. And don't forget to subscribe to the RTB channel and set a reminder so that when the next episode of Stars, Cells, and God becomes available, that you would be alerted to it. Also, check out our program 2819. Jeff is one of the hosts of the 2819 program. Maybe Jeff, just a quick description of what 2819 is, if for people that may not be familiar with that show.
Yeah, 2819 is just a show where we talk about various science faith issues in different contexts. We have kind of a cultural perspective, a scientific perspective, where we can just engage important areas to show how science and the Christian faith align with one another, so that you can be more confident in the truth of Christianity and ultimately go out and share that.
Yeah.
So great podcast.
And it's a great program for people that are kind of wading into the shallow end of the science faith conversation, right?
Yeah, well, it talks about specific topics and then gives you a place to go look deeper, but gives a brief introduction to a lot of different things.
Yeah, great. Okay, well, until next time, remember, the more that we discover about science, the more that we have reasons to believe.